Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, taking a look today at the wonderful world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Great to have him along. Thank you so much for listening in. And if you have a bug question, I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. And I would really strongly suggest you take a look at our Facebook page today at the Larry Mueller Show. We already have some photos online of questions, pictures of bugs and whatnot, and you might want to take a look at those, or maybe you've got a photo that you want to download as well. While you're there, just click like, and we're good to go. Great to have you here, Phil, and what about those gypsy moths? Spraying just concluded in a lot of areas?
Right. In so far, at least my take on it is the gypsy moths aren't doing real well, which is good news. It's much last year. Last year, we didn't see the population of caterpillars collapse until the end of June. And now it appears it may have been a little bit earlier, or we started on the light side, because I'm just not getting the calls from around the state that I'm used to having. I've had a couple that are suspicious of oak trees with very little leaf tissue on it.
Yeah.
And people haven't experienced it. But just the people I'm chatting with, it sounds like, again, we may have had a pretty good outbreak of both the virus disease and the fungus disease that knocked the caterpillars down. So that's good news.
That is good news. Wisconsin's doing an experimental release of a stingless parasitic wasp to try and control the emerald ash borer.
There are three species. In fact, I think they're doing one of the releases today for the egg parasite. Earlier this season, they released a couple larval parasites, and these are little host-specific wasps, so they really don't attack anything than gryllus beetles, and have been brought over from Asia, and they're releasing them in the Newburgh site, and then we will watch and see what kind of population reductions they cause. And, you know, I don't think anybody is realistically expecting this to solve the emerald ash borer problem, but it can slow it up considerably. And so I think people are quite optimistic as far as the long-range potentials of this.
Certainly worth a try.
Yes.
Absolutely. Terry in Green Bay has a question for you. So let's go to Terry. Hi, Terry.
Scott, good morning. I want to ask Phil, this is about deer flies. We were in the Tomahawk area, west of Tomahawk, a couple days ago. I've got some heavily wooded property in there. When we drove in, I've got a white panel van, and I mean, those deer flies were just like swarming.
Yeah, you were the Pied Piper.
They were bouncing off the side of that van.
Mm-hmm.
There were just hundreds of them, and my van is white. Do they come to color?
They do, although it's usually darker colors are even more attractive, but they're all about movement. You know, and so as you were driving slowly, I'm sure you find that they just track you and are very active. Plus, it probably doesn't hurt the heat that the engine's given off, because there is some attractancy to heat and the like. But, you know, there is a deer fly trap that is out on the market. In fact, the gentleman lives in Amro that developed it. It is a variation of a design that was a USDA Manitoba fly trap is what the official name is. But now it's called a horse pal trap. And what this is a big black beach ball that is hanging from a tripod. And the beach ball moves in the wind, and that's enough movement that it draws the deer flies and horse flies in. A little better for horse flies than deer flies, that particular one. And when they come into it, they realize it's nothing to eat, and they fly upwards, and they honestly get caught inside a cone, because, again, it's a tripod, mm-hmm. so it gets... So this is a passive trap, and once they get caught in the big pickle jar on the top, they basically die in the sunlight. And the trouble with that is you got to set it up right at the wood edge, because if you put it in the middle of the woods, they're not going to see it. And a lot of times you find deer flies and horse flies patrol right at the wood edge, waiting for something to move. I mean, that's their typical prey, the deer coming out at dusk, and they go after it. And that's, as I said, why they're attracted to movement. But if you ask about colors, I would think they'd even be more attractive to something dark than light.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Kara Lee in Beaver Dam. Hello to you.
Hello, this is Kara Lee. Thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering if Mr. Pelletieri might be able to help me with some purple lichimachia. It's a perennial that gets little yellow flowers, but mine gets defoliated before it even gets to the flowering.
Yeah,
they're little gray worm-like bugs that the minute I touch the plant fall into little things onto the ground.
Right. I have never seen this critter until this year, and all of a sudden I've decided it's having a good year. The first samples I saw were on Creeping Jenny, which is in the same genus. And then I have since seen a couple other samples, one from Door County that VJ, the county hoard agent, sent down to me. It is a sawfly. In fact, it turns out to be a European sawfly that they call a loosestrife sawfly. I haven't had enough experience with it, but I would not be surprised. Anything in that plant genus is susceptible. And the worms
and
are going to...
I have an irrigated one as well, and it is on that one too.
Yeah. So it's a curious question of why all of a sudden, and that I can't explain. My take on it, though, from the ones I've been seeing in the last week or so, is they're getting close to finishing up. The worms themselves are full grown at about an inch, and that's kind of the size that I've been seeing. But I have a dear friend that called me over that had just a huge patch of Creeping Jenny, and it was about 90% stripped down to the stems. And so these things can be quite dramatic. I think the bigger concern, I mean, if they're still there, most garden insecticides, even insecticidal soap, will give you a pretty good chance. The old insecticide 7 is a very good worm killer. Spinosad would be an interesting product to try. That's an organic product, but I'm really not sure
what
the...
What is it called?
Spinosad is S-P-I-N-O-S-A-D.
Okay.
It is an organic product that kills caterpillars quite well. I just have not seen it used enough against sawflies, but I would suspect it would work. But I think the other thing to keep in mind for next year is that it would really be worth the effort of taking a look at these plants in the early part of June, because then the worms are going to be small enough that I know the soaps will work very well, but I think you can make an impact before they get a chance to defoliate the plants.
Okay. It's going to just shake the plant continually, but I suppose they just winter over and start in again.
Yeah, and you know, it may just be because I have historically seen some species of sawflies that I only see once every 7 or 8 years that are normally under natural control. But this being a European species, I'm not even sure if it's not a relatively new introduction. The little bit of background I could pick up on it was some discussions up in Ontario about 3 or 4 years ago, which gets me the impression that maybe it is just starting to move into the area.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling, Carolee. Appreciate it. Turning to our Facebook page, got a photo from Dana, who says, "What is this bug and how do I get rid of it? They're doing my ornamental apple tree leaves and they are out of control. Thanks."
That is the classic rose chafer. And the first thing I can tell from seeing that insect is she must live in a sandy area, because you only find that insect in sandy parts of the state. It behaves a lot like a Japanese beetle. It breeds in sites off your property and then it comes attracted into your yard and feeds on a variety of things, raspberries, apples, and the like. And a couple thoughts. The tree itself, the damage is really more cosmetic. I mean, I'm not worrying about the tree dying from the feeding. As far as is applications, most landscape sprays would work. In this case, you got to get something labeled for fruit trees, realizing that will help you for about 5 to 6 days. But these things are flying for 2 to 3 weeks, so you may have to apply more than once. The one other option to consider for next year, it's a little short this year, but they do sell rose chafer traps. Now, we're not real keen on Japanese beetle traps because we know it makes life worse rather than better. But rose chafer traps, if used correctly, should be able to drastically reduce the populations and not cause the breeding problems and other things that the Japanese beetle traps have. Unfortunately, the only way I know of getting rose chafer traps is to order them through the internet. There's a company called Great Lakes IPM that's out of Michigan that sells the traps. They're basically an attractant that draws them in. They have a little yellow baffle that they bump into, and then they collect in a container underneath it. So it's the same design as the Japanese beetle trap, but the attractant they use is a different chemical. And if you can move this away, if you've got a very small property, the traps won't be very effective. But if you've got some decent area, you can set the traps away from your garden so you're drawing the beetles away. And again, you'll collect literally hundreds of them and kill them.
And here's another photo. This one's not insect-related, though, I'm pretty sure. These holes are all over the tree, Gina says. They're not very deep, but perfectly round, and they're pretty much in a line.
Yeah, when I see holes in lines, and I talk to people about that, I mean, my insects are not that dainty. And so this usually turns out to be sapsucker feeding, which is a bird, and they injure the tree and will feed on the sap that comes. And a lot of times you'll get a series of lines in a pattern. Now, this particular one, it doesn't look like the tree's bleeding, so that might be some old injury and the tree heals over it. I know one of the things that Dr. Craven sometimes suggests in these cases, you can use hardware cloth over the injury site to keep the bird and convince it to go elsewhere and allow it to heal up. But, you know, again, the size and diameter of the holes could be insect-related, but the insect hole emergences would always be much more random, never in that straight line pattern.
Emily and Madison, we are on to you now. Hi, Emily.
Hello. Good morning. My question is, I have this insect. I'm not sure what it is. It's taken up residence in my front lawn. And we thought it was a series of ant mounds, ant hills. But then when we knocked off the top of the ant hill, it was more of a mud consistency rather than sand. And then the bugs coming out were not ants. They were, it looked like kind of a small hornet. But instead of instead of yellow and black stripes, it was green, like kind of an iridescent green and black stripe. And they do fly, and then they burrow down into these little holes in the mounds. And they're kind of there are maybe, I don't know, 6 to 10 of these mounds in my front lawn. I have no idea what they are or how to get rid of them.
Okay, well, you know, it could be a bee, it could be a hornet. I can't tell for sure without getting a closer look at it. These would be what we would call solitary bees or hornets. And some of them do dig burrows. In the case of bees, they go out and collect pollen, put it into the burrow, lay their egg, and then they have no maternal care. They basically, they die off and their young raise themselves. Because of this, that's not a true nest. And the common theme you have with solitary bees and wasps is that they do not act very aggressively because there's no nest to defend. Now, in the case of wasps, it's the same story. It's a burrow, but rather than using flower pollen, they utilize various insects, crickets, leafhoppers. It depends on which species of wasp. What one would expect is the activity of the adults might go 3 to 4 weeks at best, and then you won't see anything more. And so, you know, I don't really normally worry that much about them. As I said, even if you walk over the nest and the like, they really aren't going to get agitated. Even if you drive the lawnmower over it, to be honest, I would not anticipate that they would be aggressive because there is no true nest for them to defend. As far as if the lawn was extremely lush, so there was no barren soil, they probably wouldn't be in there. So there must be some just somewhat open patches because you tend to find that that's what they prefer. But normally I would suggest it's not worth bothering with. If you absolutely felt that you needed to do something, in this case, using a garden dust type insecticide would be the way to go. And you just dust in the burrows and when they come and go. But in the case, if these are bees, you know, we're trying to promote native bees, not hurt them. And if they are wasps, especially of this type, as I said, they're not very aggressive and they're usually collecting some kind of caterpillars or other things that we probably are happy that they're feeding on. So just something to consider. I normally said if we were to chat about this, I would suggest that it's not worth the effort.
Okay, great. Thanks for your help.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And Dennis in Stoughton, we're on to you now. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. Thank you. I'd like to get an armchair insect information and identification book, something along the lines of, I've seen Stan Tequila, if I pronounce his name right, Wildflowers of Wisconsin, Birds of Wisconsin, where he groups things according to color or time that they come out, but I'm not looking for a scientific identification system, more something specific to our area and written in a readable way like Stan Tequila's work.
Okay. Well, I mean, insects, what gets us in trouble is the sheer numbers. I mean, we guesstimate we've got about 25,000 species in the state. And two books to consider. I'm not sure they'll totally fit. A colleague of mine up in Minnesota, Jeff Hahn, is written Insects of the North Woods is the book. It's a field guide. It is well done, considering the limitations of how many insects you can put in the book. And it does by family, by order, in the common families, and the like. And so that's kind of a general treatise of things that go through. And there are more specific books on dragonflies of the North Woods and spiders of the North Woods. The other one that I suggest, and this is probably more for the gardeners, there's a book that came out about 4 years ago called Garden Insects of North America. And the author is Whitney Cranshaw. And what I was very impressed with that book is there is lots of pictures And aside from just garden pests and in plant pests in your lawn and on your ornamental plants, he has some beneficial insects. He has some big, ugly insects. I mean, it's a pretty good treatise. And they're kind of put into categories, you know, chewing insects, sucking insects, fruit damaging insects. Where it will be a little bit light is if you were walking in the woods and some of the interesting things you could find there probably would not be pictured there. And that's the dilemma, as I said, this sheer number. So if you're looking for a general treatise, I think the Insects of the North Woods series would be one to seriously consider. If you're looking more for the things that you might find in your yard, in not just pest species, just some curious things, you know, like Cecropia moths and what would be pictured. The Garden Insects of North America by Whitney Cranshaw. It's a Princeton University book, and boy, you can get it on Amazon for around $20, which is absolutely mind-boggling when you see how many color pictures are in the book.
There you go, Dennis. Thank you very much for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join our conversation today as we talk insects with Phil Pelletieri, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And you can also post a picture or a comment or a question on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show for that. And speaking of the Facebook page, Phil, Steve has a picture of an option that he uses for attracting deer flies.
Well, you know, it's interesting to look at. He has basically a blue cup, and I find the color very interesting, and I'll tell you why in a second. You know, deer flies are attracted to movement. My colleagues down at Louisiana State found they took a yellow or a blue flower pot, and, you know, plastic one, and they covered it with a product called Tanglefoot, which is very sticky. They put it on the back of their lawnmower, because one of the problems is when they were mowing the lawns, they were attacking. And so these things were drawn to it, and they get stuck in the Tanglefoot. And this is basically a variation of that, is he's got some sticky material next to the blue. I had a very curious conversation a few years back and a delightful picture from a gentleman. We were talking. He lived in the Cambridge area, and every time he went walking, the deer flies would bite him and his dog, and it was... So I was telling him about this Tanglefoot thing. He took a black flower pot, and he covered it with Tanglefoot, and he put it on his head, and he shared with me a picture of probably 150 deer flies stuck on it. Now, when he put it on, he looked kind of like a strange Shriner. I mean, this is not a fashion statement by any means. There's another version of this you might have seen in the sporting goods. It's a treadknot deer fly trap, which is basically a sticky double-sided card that you put on your hat when you're fishing. And the same thing happens. They're drawn in, they land thinking there's something to bite, and they get stuck. So this is just a bigger version of it. but for deer flies in particular, kind of a light blue is a better color. For horse flies in particular, again, the black tends to be more attractive, or the most attractive of all the colors that are out there.
Well, it's pretty cool. It's worth taking a look at. If you haven't been to the Facebook page, go to the Larry Mueller Show and take a look. Let's go to Brian in Dorchester. Hi, Brian.
Hey, all right, Dorchester.
Great to have you with us. What's on your mind today?
Over the last few years, I read a couple of articles about this mysterious insect that's capable of attaining high speeds in flight. And I'm remembering something like 150 miles an hour, but I guess because it's so elusive, they don't know much about it. Is that something you've heard about? Is that for real?
I have not. You never say never in the insect world, but you know the top speeds I'm used to seeing is in about the 35 to 40 mile an hour range. And when you look at the number of wing beats it takes for an insect to attain that, I don't know how in the devil they could get up into that 150 mile speed range without jumping off cliffs and using other tricks to go to them. So no, I'm not familiar with it.
There you go. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Maybe somebody else has heard about it. So stay listening, Brian. Let's go to Leonard in Oshkosh next. Hi, Leonard.
I'm going to be going up to the Sylvania Wilderness here soon, and I understand there's a lot of mosquitoes. And I'm wondering if that you've had any experience with that Thermacell product or any other suggestions to help keep the mosquitoes away.
Really, too. When I get into ridiculous mosquitoes and I want to enjoy the outdoors, to be honest, I have a mesh suit that I put on that is a very fine screening like you get on the end of a tent, you know, the kind of no-see-um mesh.
Sure.
And I can wear a T-shirt underneath that, and it's got a hood. And so when I'm up in the boundary waters or whatnot and things get nasty, I just pull that out of the packet. You know, it folds real nice. Now, thermocells really do work quite well, but what you have to understand about them is that if you're stationary and there is not much wind, they basically put a cloud of insecticide that prevents the mosquitoes from getting to you. If you're moving, the product doesn't build up, or if it's quite windy. Now, the good thing about what being a quite windy, there won't be much mosquito activity.
Sure.
The thermocells really, you know, a lot of people who, you know, deer hunters or whatnot are sitting up in tree stands in September, absolutely have nothing but nice things to say about them. And so once you realize where they'll work and where they won't work, it'll be fine. So sitting around the campfire and whatnot, having one next to you really will make a difference as long as it's a still night.
Sure. Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Glenn in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Glenn. Glenn, are you there? Maybe we lost Glenn. Let's try another call. Let's try Jamie in Green Bay. Jamie, hello to you.
Hi there. I have a question about honeybees. We had a neighbor who has a honeybee hive, and he's had it for over a year. And a couple of weekends ago, they swarmed, and we were just wondering exactly what was going on. I was right in the middle of the swarm and not afraid at all.
Mm-hmm.
It was just amazing to be there. They were just a huge column of bees, and we were thinking that maybe there was a new queen that they were trying to relocate.
Yes, it's basically, it's kind of a dividing process of the colony where one queen will take off with the swarm and a new queen will be established in the old nest. And it's not a good thing for beekeepers to have happen because they're losing their livestock, basically. And so, you know, beekeepers will manipulate the colony to prevent this from happening. They, you know, but what will happen typically, it's, you know, it's a phenomena that, again, the bees are very non-aggressive at that point. You'll usually see this ball of bees sitting on a fence post or a tree limb somewhere. And when people find that phenomenon, we tell them, just be patient, because what the bees are doing is are looking for a place to move in. They've got scout bees that are out and about, and they'll find a hollow tree or something similar to move into. And once they find it, everybody will leave and move into that. So we never get concerned when we see swarms in the backyard, because they said they're a very short-lived phenomena. And now, the longer the swarm sits there, the bees do get a little bit grumpy, but they're still extremely docile under those circumstances. And as I said, it's really an interesting phenomenon to observe.
And we were able to actually entice them into a new box and move the box further away from the original hive, and they're still in it. So they were able to capture them and keep the new hive going in the same yard.
Definitely. So beekeepers have ways that they can manipulate it in start colonies. It's just getting control of it. And as I said, normally, though, since you're not always around watching things, you don't want your bees to take off, because, again,
right,
it's kind of like leaving the barn door open and half of them are gone, and who knows where they'll show up.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Jamie. An email from Kathy in Eau Claire. Last year, the earwigs were abundant. They decimated my marigolds and dahlias and so forth, and this year I've only seen a few of them, and the marigolds have not been touched. Is it just too early? Or is this year somehow different from last year? And she's calling from or emailing from Eau Claire.
Right.
By the way, while I'm at it, when you email or post something on the Facebook page, please indicate where you're from. That helps Phil
right,
a little bit.
I'm guessing the populations are down considerably, because I normally figure for most of Wisconsin that the earwigs are coming out of the ground as half-grown nymphs about Memorial Day. And that's been my observation, too, is there's just nothing crawling around in the backyard. It wouldn't surprise me later on. I'll see a couple. But normally, the populations are the highest in June and early July. That's when we see most of our plant damage. And so that's very encouraging. And again, I tease people about marigolds, but that's the only plant I know that they will run across your yard to feed on. It is just, they're very attracted to it. And they, you know, it's mysterious, because the feeding goes on at night, and during the day people don't see it. And so you blame it on rabbits and other critters. But as I said, it's a great indicator plant. And if you're not seeing feeding damage now, they're not going to be there this year.
And Deborah in Lodi wonders what happened to the tent worms this year. We have almost none.
I think the weather stressed them out. I don't think the winter was cold enough to expect it to kill the eggs. But I think that cool spring, sometimes when you wake insects up and then you get into these cold, wet spells, you can really shut them down. So I agree that the tent caterpillars were down considerably as far as eastern tent, the one that makes the big webs. I will say that the forest tent caterpillar, which doesn't make the big webs, in the southern part of the state, I probably saw higher than normal numbers. And the worms themselves, you can tell apart. The eastern tent caterpillar has a solid white stripe right down the back, slightly fuzzy black caterpillar with a little bit of bluish markings. Almost the same pattern on forest tent, except it's a broken line of white dots down the back. The food plants are different. Eastern tent is on flowering fruit trees. Forest tent is on oaks and poplar in particular. But yes, I would say eastern tent caterpillar had probably the lightest year I've seen in about the last 4 or 5 years.
Mm. And related, Sandy from Wausau was wondering what appeared to be tent caterpillars. They made a huge tent-shaped web in her flowering crab. Caught it early. The foliage of the tree seems to have suffered a bit from it. I was able to pick most of them off and wrap the tree trunk in reverse duct tape, and that worked swell. Why didn't the birds eat them off the tree? They look like they may taste nasty.
I think that bluebirds in particular are very fond of tent caterpillars, both forest and what protects them is the tent, you know, and so you will find a lot of times during the day they lay pretty low, and they do more of their feeding at night and whatnot when there's less bird activity. But there really, as far as I'm aware of, no compounds internally that would make them that distasteful to birds.
On to Glenn in Milwaukee. Hi, Glenn. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I've got a question about ants. I believe it was last week you were talking about digging a hole into the nest or into the mound of ants and pouring 7 in.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to the store to look at the bottle of 7, it said it doesn't work on carpenter ants, and these are black ants that are there.
I would love to see that label, because that doesn't make any sense to me. The only thing that they may have been referring to is that 7 used to have a much broader label and was allowed to be used indoors. The labels that I see now are basically for treating your lawns, vegetables, and plants, but are not labeled for treating indoors. And so that may have been, since carpenter ants do nest indoors on occasion. But, 7's an interesting product. One of its personality traits is it's highly toxic to things in the hymenopter group. Unfortunately, that includes bees, but it also includes things like the sawflies we talked about earlier that were on the Lismachia. And also, I consider it a very effective ant material. So I find that a little bit interesting and wonder again what the reasoning is that
Florida ants or something like that, Florida something or other. I think the word Florida came up.
Well, there is a Florida carpenter ant, but again, I wouldn't know why that particular species would be. Now, fire ants, I'm not so sure. I mean, that gets a little bit trickier. And again, we don't have fire ants in the state, thank goodness. But as I said, it was one, there are plenty of other products. I mean, to me, dealing with ants is more about getting it to where you need to. And again, in those big field ants, you're trying to kill the queen that might be 2, 3, or 3 feet deep. And one of the reasons that 7 is often suggested, aside from being quite effective against ants, it's readily available easy to find. Although I prefer the liquid form in this particular case, which also is sometimes an issue with people, is, you know, the dusts are okay, but you can't get them in as easy. The powders, maybe you can get them suspended okay, but I just like the liquids because they mix so easily.
Mm-hmm. Do you use the concentrated one or the one that's pre-mixed?
I personally think you get economically wise, you get a better thing by using the concentrate. Just put the teaspoon in the gallon of water and you're off and running.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Larry in Waupaca, we're on to you now. Hi, Larry.
Hi, how are you this afternoon?
Great, thanks for calling.
Yes, my question is about ticks and a new disease that they're carrying I've heard of. I'm not going to pronounce the word right, Bomias, and what concerns should we be looking at? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, the one it might be, I mean, there is a babesiosis, which is...
Yes.
Is that the one it sounds like?
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Yep.
Okay. It's another mouse-borne disease. It is not near as prevalent as far as number of cases reported. We've had a few dozen in Wisconsin historically, not the thousands like we've had of Lyme disease. One of the interesting conversations I've seen on this is that a lot of us don't react to the disease. You know, one of the studies they can do is to test your blood for the presence of antibodies, and they find people that spend a lot of time outdoors, quite a few of them have been exposed to babesiosis, but not that many of them got sick. Now, when you do get sick, in most people, it presents like a flu-like disease. And unfortunately, that's what a lot of these things do, is fever and body aches. Where there has been some concern starting to be come up is that this can potentially taint our blood supply. The disease, honestly, has some similarities to malaria.
Oh.
It's a blood parasite. And there is some conversation, as this is becoming more commonplace, that we may have to start testing for it, because the people that would be most prone to problems here is people that get transfusions that have compromised immune systems. And in that case, it can be fatal. And so, as I said, so there has been quite a bit of discussion. Much like Lyme disease has been on the increase, it appears that this babesiosis has been on the increase. But again, the interesting fact is that it appears that a lot of people don't get sick from it, which is good. But as I said, if you're donating blood, the discussion is, will we have to put this in as some of the other tests that they do to try to screen blood to make sure it's not carrying parasites that we don't want it to?
Hmm. Oh, so you see this as a future test is going to be conducted?
Well, I'll be honest, I read an article about it yesterday, and it was still in the conversation, they're raising that question. Is it becoming commonplace enough and of concern enough that we're going to have to add this? We're not there yet, but it, as I said, it's becoming commonplace enough that people are starting to be concerned.
Okay, one more quick question. If I'm sitting out on my deck, how fast would my fan have to be blowing so a mosquito couldn't fly in it? And thank you.
Yeah, I usually figure, you know, something approaching 10 miles an hour. So it's not a real heavy breeze, but...
probably medium on the...
Yeah, medium, I would think, in most cases, should be more than sufficient.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And a caller from Sparta is being inundated by gnats. It's impossible to sit outside because of them. Is there a way to repel them?
Well, I'm guessing they're black flies. And, you know, gnat is a generic term for small flies. And usually when people talk to me about having gnats, I often have to request a sample because there's so many possibilities. But what black flies are notorious about is flying around your head. And, you know, there are human biting species, but most of the black flies are bird feeders. And indeed, we've had complaints. In fact, I had done a couple pieces with the lacrosse paper and whatnot, and also down around the Platteville area in the last 2 or 3 weeks of people complaining about gnats around their head. Now, the good thing about black flies is the season is much shorter than mosquito season, so they may just be going away. Because they're not landing, repellents really are not very effective. Because then what the repellent does is prevent them from biting you, but it doesn't stop them. Once they get about 4 inches away, it doesn't matter if you got repellents or not. So this might be another case, again, where you get out the fan and try to blow them away that way. And we had an emergence of the species that feeds on bluebirds this year, because a lot of people that were monitoring bluebird nests told me of major reproductive failures, especially in the southwest part of the state. And typically that's a black fly species that comes off both the Wisconsin River and also the Mississippi. It's a large river breeder. And we haven't seen this phenomena for about 5 or 6 years, but definitely, as I said, the reports that I have been getting in the last 2 or 3 weeks would substantiate that. And that is a bird feeding species of black fly. So as I said, if I had to guess, that's what's bothering you. It's when you're close to rivers and moving water, that's where black flies come from. But I'm hopeful in the next week or two that things will lessen considerably and it will be a non-issue for the rest of the year.
Daniel in Rice Lake, it's your turn now. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. By Tombstone, Arizona last winter, I saw a bumbling, large-bodied bug. When agitated, it stuck its butt in the air. A Native American called it a stink bug. How effective is the stink bug's chemical defense?
Well, you know, I'm guessing it's a beetle rather than a bug. It turns out that we have bombardier beetles, which are a very interesting group that does this. But what they literally do is mix hydrogen peroxide with some other chemicals, and it basically is a burning product that they use to protect themselves. Now, it does turn out that there are other species of beetles. I'm wondering if this is one of the big tenebrionid beetles, or we call them darkling beetles, and there's some big ones in the Southwest that, again, have some odors that they use. I mean, usually when an insect is stopping and doing something rather than running away from you, they have some chemical defense to protect themselves, and mostly from predators. Now, you watch certain things like lizards and whatnot don't seem to be all that bothered by some of this stuff, and they'll still gobble it up. But birds and some of the other things do have protection. So it is a very effective mechanism when insects utilize it. And as I said, that's what would be my guess, is these beetles are basically using glands on the posterior of their abdomen, and whether they're giving off chemicals right away or, as I said, in the case of the bombardier beetle, it's really chemical warfare they're using to keep predators away.
Thanks, Dan, for calling. Joy in Madison, your turn. Hi, Joy.
Yeah, good morning. I'm wondering, every so often when I'm sitting on the porch, a tiny little fly-like critter will come and be on my arm. The body is no more than an eighth of an inch, and it's all lime green with clear wings. And they're occasional, and they're not offensive in any way. I'm just curious what that might be.
Two possibilities. To be honest, there's some very small little lake flies that would fit that description. Lake flies would have one pair of wings, but if they're really more elongated and the wings are kind of held roof-like over the body, it's a little leafhopper. There are various leafhoppers. There's normally plant-feeding species of one sort or another, some of them have this almost neon green color form to them, so that would be my guess.
There you go. Thank you very much. And Jim in Dunn County. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Good.
Good. I got a question for Phil about deer flies. How many species do we actually have in Wisconsin?
Deer flies alone, I think we're about 18 or 19 is my guess. And then if you add horse flies to it, we got another 15 or so. So we're over 30 species of that whole family of tabanids.
Oh, gosh. I only counted four out here where I live, but... that was enough for me.
Yeah.
Plenty enough, huh? Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. If you'd like to join in, we have open lines now and get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And if you want to post a question or a picture as well, you can go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show and do it there. Larry Mueller with Judith Sears Poisson, our producer, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And a Facebook question from Nola, who says, I'm curious about what I just heard, Phil. We do seem to have fire ants here in Wisconsin. If these big mounds of ants are not fire ants, then what the heck are they? Mounds of thousands of biting ants, black and red bodies.
Right. Those are in the genus Formica. We call them field ants. True fire ants sting. It's a whole different ballgame, whereas our field ants bite. And yes, you know, it's not a pleasant sensation. And you don't mess with their nests without expecting them to retaliate. But it's a very different process and far less serious because, of course, when you're stung, there are venoms that are put in and that's what people react to. Whereas when you're bit, it really is just a nice pinch is what's going on. And, you know, they make huge mounds. Those mounds can be there for 8 to 10 years. We have trouble. This is the one we talk about so often in the show where the mound's 3 feet high and 4 feet wide and I can't even drive my lawnmower over it type of thing. Or, interesting enough, some of these species manipulate the vegetation around them. They don't like their nest shaded. It's a thermoregulation process they have, and they literally will bite and then inject formic acid into the roots of the plant and kill it. So we've seen Christmas trees as high as 4 or 5 feet killed by the ants.
Boy.
And so they do have a bit of a mean disposition. On the other hand, they're not an ant that comes indoors, so they don't bother us for food typically. They also are predaceous on lots of pest insects, so there's a real beneficial side to it. Common, most of the species, we have a couple that you might see in the woods, but most of them are more open ground species, you know, prairies, pastures, that kind of thing.
And we had an email from Nora who says, when I was in Zimbabwe, I saw tsetse fly traps. They were black and blue, coated with a sticky substance. Interesting to know that halfway around the world, biting flies are attracted to the same colors.
Yeah, in fact, I think, you know, more work, because tsetse fly spreads African sleeping sickness, and it's more of the work that has been done in Africa that's helped us here. There is a commercial fly trap available called an EPS, EPS fly trap, and it is a big black panel, and it has a little water tray underneath it. It works quite well for some of the biting flies, including stable flies in particular. That basically, again, is the derivation of the tsetse fly traps that you find in Africa.
We had another photograph up, and I'm not sure. This was from Gina. A photograph looks like an oak leaf. These look like cocoons of some sort, maybe.
The picture isn't clear enough. My guess, it's the maple tree. If it was a maple tree, I know exactly what it is. Oh. I wonder if this is a little spindle gall, which is a little piece of reddish tube-like plant flesh that is induced by an aerified mite. So the mite irritates the plant. It grows in this way. And one of the ways you can tell is a cocoon you could be able to pull off pretty easy, whereas these spindle galls would be attached because it is plant tissue. The good news is it's cosmetic. It doesn't hurt the tree, not worth bothering with. There's two other forms of aerified mites on maples, one that causes a small round gall that we call a bladder gall. And these also sometimes will take a reddish cast as they mature, sometimes a blackish cast. And then there's one that causes a bright silver red. This is very common on silver maple, a bright scarlet red velvety growth on the underside of the leaf that's called an erinium gall. These are all caused by the aerified mites, which is the family of gall mites. And as I said, the good news about all of these is that they're harmless. We had a real common one last year on river birch. And the one on river birch causes a pink velvety growth on the undersides of the leaves. And so sometimes they're pretty bizarre looking, something that you don't normally see in nature. But as I said, they really don't hurt the plant.
On to Michael in Madison. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question and hopefully followed by a hint related to a question from an earlier caller. I live in a fairly protected area in a woodland that's not subjected to a lot of agricultural sprays. And one evening, at nighttime, I was out in my yard looking around, observing the sky, and I noticed something glowing in my yard on the floor of my backyard. And it's a caterpillar, a segmented caterpillar, about an inch and a quarter of length, and it appears to be expressing some type of bioluminescence in a biphasic pattern. It has rings that go around it almost completely. That correlate to the segment of the caterpillar, and then there are dots on the ventral aspect of this caterpillar where the legs are. And I wonder if Dr. Pelletieri has any idea what this might be.
Sure. I don't think it's a caterpillar. I think it's the larval stage of a beetle that we call a glowworm. Glowworms are related to fireflies, but you don't get that flashing light like you do in adult fireflies. You get this kind of steady glow. And to be honest, they're predators on millipedes in the larval stage. And they have this interesting phenomenon. If you ever look up glowworms on the internet and look for pictures, the adult male is the bizarrest looking thing. It doesn't look like a beetle at all. It's got these great big plumose antennae. It doesn't have a hard shell on the outer side. It's a strange bug. But what happens with most of the glowworm species, the females never develop into an adult stage, per se. We call this a larva form adult. So she stays in the worm stage, and then the male mates with her, and she lays her eggs and the like. It's not unusual, if you get lucky enough to find them, to see a group of them, and I would expect to find them more in a wooded habitat with a lot of leaf litter, because, again, that's where you find a lot of millipedes. That's where you keep the moisture levels up. And so they are true. And the way they produce the light is the same mechanism as fireflies. It's just not under that on and off trigger like we see in adult male fireflies.
That's excellent. Thank you very much. You described my lawn to a T. I actually don't have a lawn anymore. I've done away with it. And so I leave the leaf litter and I leave everything growing. And it's going to take another 10 years and I'll be completely embedded in a woodlot. My hint was just related to questions about repelling deer flies and whatnot. And I heard someone say about a pot of some sticky thing you can put on your head. Well, I'm an avid runner, and I take dryer towels or dryer sheets, one or two, and pin them to the back of a cap when I'm running. And the flies appear to be attracted to the movement, but once they get close enough to land on it or get close enough to get some of that scent, it seems to deter them. It's not 100% effective. Some will find around and land on my shoulder and give me a sting, but it's about 95% effective, and it sure doesn't hamper my running.
Well, that's interesting because one of the solutions that I had seen put forward for the bluebird houses that were getting attacked by black flies is to take a dryer sheet and just tack it on the front. And I just have had no experience with it. So I really, really not sure what's going on there. But it's interesting, those observations that people are getting success with them.
Thanks for calling.
You're welcome.
Wesley in Eau Claire, your turn now. Hi, Wes.
Yes, thank you very much. Me and my girlfriend like to go swimming up at Big River, Big Falls, up near Fall Creek, Wisconsin, and we're constantly pestered by large flies when we're swimming. And it's a public place, so we can't really set traps like you guys were talking about earlier. Is there any suggestions to keep those flies off of us?
Boy, it's tough. You're probably dealing with what we would call a stable fly. Stable flies are also called heel flies or biting house flies. House flies don't have a mechanism to bite, but if you look at these things side by side, they're incredibly look incredibly similar. There's just some differences in the venation of the wing and also in the mouth parts. And they're attracted, honestly, to shiny things. And so we see a lot of trouble around beaches because when you're coming out, you're all shiny and the like. And they're very quick flyers. And, you know, when you look at an insect's biology, you try to look at a weakness. And the weakness of some flies, to be honest, is that they land on certain surfaces. So you can use sticky fly traps or insecticides that have some residual. But stable flies don't. I mean, they just basically patrol. And so, as I said, other than these trap designs that are drawing them in, I really don't know anything that's very effective. And they breed in decaying vegetable matter, including seaweed, interesting enough. So that's also one of the reasons you see them around lakes. But the other thing that has been documented that stable flies can come in from 20 to as far as 200 miles down the road. So you're not even sure when you get attacked by a lake that the breeding source is local, which again makes it quite frustrating to deal with them.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. And Peter in Mosinee, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Peter.
Thank you very much. I'd like to ask Dr. Pelletier a question about the health of honeybees. I'm a small scale amateur beekeeper, and I've always been battling tracheal mites and varroa mites. And then I would like to follow up with a suggestion for you, Larry.
Okay,
sure. I rely on. We used to be fortunate enough to have a USDA bee lab in the department I am, but unfortunately they left the state now well over 20 years ago or so. But I still have a colleague, Emmett Harp, who was the bee breeder for the bee lab. And he's my resource because we do not have honeybee expertise in the department. We do rely on Marla Spivak, Dr. Marla Spivak of Minnesota, who's doing a lot of neat stuff. What I'm hearing from Emmett is that, you know, the varroa mite still is just a tough one to deal with. And a lot of times when we're getting bee losses and whatnot, he's relating it to the weakening of the colony in response to that and the difficulty he's having. And, you know, we've had resistance problems and the like. I know coming into the spring, the mortality was up a little bit above the norm, you know, the 35% to 40% bee loss. A lot of that, again, relates, I think, to the weakness of the colonies going into the winter because of these parasites and the like. But, you know, bees that are well cared for, you know, when they talk about the collapse disorder complications and whatnot, so much of this is spinning off from stress in bees that are well cared for. So I find hobby beekeepers that have three or four colonies that have some experience and really do babysit their bees well are really having very good success. So, you know, sometimes when you read some of these articles in the paper, they paint that, you know, the honeybee is going to become extinct and whatnot. And I don't think is a realistic way of looking at it. And overall, in Wisconsin, we seem to have less major issues because we're not so much into the major pollination services that where we're seeing the huge bee losses, the people that go from Florida to pollinate almonds in California and truck them across the nation. I mean, that is a major stress factor, and we're seeing that those people are the ones that are having some difficulty. But there even was less collapse disorder when they found that if they would increase the nutrition of the bees and have stronger, healthier bees, they were having less problems. So, as I said, as we're starting to get some handle, even though I don't think we all agree completely what the collapse disorder is about. And there's other parasites, there's nosema going on, there's virus issues, and so it's a pretty complex picture. But overall, as I said, I find that people that have smaller numbers of bees and are doing a good job of taking care of them are having some pretty good success.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I'd like to ask Larry that when he has guests, for instance, the sod and turf fellows that come in, if they could speak about bee habitat that's in, like, white clover, which is a prodigious bee food. The tree people who talk about people planting trees for good bee or honey producing trees, like white locust or black locust is a very good one, and basswood is really good. Kind of weave bee culture into the whole framework, because it's so important to keep these pollinators, both domestic and natural, going out there. And I just wanted to say mazel tov to the person who was able to capture that swarm. was that your guest earlier? You know, a swarm in the spring is worth a load of hay, they say. So, congratulations to them. And that's how I got back into beekeeping, as a wild swarm moved into some old equipment up in the barn. And I said, well, got to do it.
That's wonderful. Peter, thank you so much. Thanks. And it is worth working some of that in, too, because...
Well, you know, probably the biggest area, not just honeybees, but the native pollinators has been an area that has really increased in interest. Because, again, you know, part of the risk is if we do see the honeybees get further problems, there's puts more pressure. And so even in the Farm Bill, as they said, there's a lot more stuff I'm seeing on the Internet. In fact, there was a book that Eric Mader and Marla Spivak put out about beekeeping in general. It's very good, that you can get from the Xerxes Society.
Excellent. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, will be our guest right up until 12:30 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we'll take some calls if you would like to join again. Again, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Sharon in Amherst has a question for you, Phil. So let's go to Sharon. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. My question is, well, my husband was diagnosed two years ago with blastomycosis, and it got into his bone, and he lost most of his heel bone. Now, my question is, with the ticks, because his antibodies in his blood system, his immune system is so poor, and the ticks love him. Now, with this new tick, what signs should I look for? Because he gets such nasty bites.
Well, in particular, you start worrying about fevers, body aches, and potential surface rashes. You know, the thing about all of this is that the deer tick seems to be the big culprit, that wood ticks, you know, even though they spread Rocky Mountain spotted fever, that's almost a non-existent disease. I mean, we've had like 5 cases in 3 decades here. But the deer tick spreads both babesiosis, Lyme disease, and there is a human granular auriculosis that is a third disease that is picked up from the mice. And each of these is somewhat different, is treated somewhat differently, but honestly, they all present the same kind of thing, is headaches, body aches, fevers. But it takes the tick probably 24 hours minimum, if not longer, to transmit the disease. So as long as we're getting these things off quick, but that would be something to watch, and it may be something to talk to your family physician about doing the blood work, because that's basically what they use to diagnose this stuff, that if there's any problem, or even maybe once a year running the blood work just to see if he's been exposed to any of those diseases.
Well, they've tested for Lyme's, and he's been clear of that, and he has all these symptoms, but we don't know if it's the blasto causing it, or if it's, you know, because his antibodies, and he's always ill. He has more bad days than good. You know, and the blast that he had was so bad, I mean, it just almost killed him. Now my concern, the way ticks are, he can just walk through the grass, and he's just loaded, and the bites he gets are just huge. I mean, mm-hmm. Just they're terrible. I've never seen a person react to tick bites like he does.
Well, you know, one of the things to consider there is, you know, the permethrin clothing sprays will kill the ticks. I mean, they're sold as a repellent, but they really kill them, and they really are very effective, and that may be a way of at least reducing some of the problems he has. And, you know, you can put those on work coveralls, spray them once, and they'll last basically till you wash the coveralls. And so you don't have to reapply it all the time. He just has to remember to put on the coveralls when he's out for his walk.
Okay.
All right. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Penny and Edgerton, we're on to you. Hi, Penny.
Hi. I have a question about Asian lady beetles. My mother told me that the fruit from the Osage orange tree would function as a repellent for those, and we have nasty infestations of those here in Edgerton. So we happen to have an Osage orange tree.
Ooh.
And I took a dozen, 15 of the fruit, the little brain-like green fruit, and just dropped them around the base of the house last fall. And we had the least number of Asian beetles that we've ever had.
Yeah,
and I don't know if that's just a weird...
No, I think that's an artifact that their populations are down statewide.
Oh, good. Okay.
Now, what I know of Osage orange, because this has been used commonly as a spider repellent, and has been scientifically tested, and it turns out that there are some chemicals within the fruit that do have some repellency, but it's short-term or short distance. And we're talking a matter of 18 inches, 20 inches, nothing longer than that. And so even if it did for Asian lady beetle, I would expect the same experience. If you were to tell me you were to take the fruit, crush it, and then spray this on the outside of the house, that may be potentially more successful. But as I said, without it being tested, I mean, one of the questions would be how long does it last before it degrades? Because that's the strategy for Asian lady beetle that's used, is spraying various insecticides on the outside of the house in the end of September that both repel them. They're all pyrethroids that repel them and also kill them if they get past it. And so they said, I think there's a partial truth there, but I think what you witnessed last spring or last fall is that their numbers are not near what they were 10 years ago in most of the state.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. On our Facebook page, Michael wonders, are emerald ash borer and Dutch elm tree treatments effective? I don't know. He doesn't say if he's trying to prevent or I assume.
It's two different strategies. I mean, what they're using for Dutch elm disease is a curative product that prevents the disease that's in the vascular system. Whereas in the emerald ash borer stuff, there are various insecticides that have systemic activity. And so that part is the same, as we're injecting it in the tree to do their things, but one's attacking a fungus, one's attacking an insect. And usually the Dutch elm disease is a curative, so it has it, and you give it to it. And although people treat it that way, they're using it more as a preventative. We treat the tree, have the insecticide in before the emerald ash borer shows up, and prevent it from establishing that way. So there are some differences.
And also on our Facebook page was some photos that you saw from Karen. We were in Carlos, Minnesota, the weekend of June 10, 11, when the lake flies hatched. It was quite an infestation. Lasted 48 hours before they died. Seems like they were hatching from the ground. How often do they hatch, and how might we get rid of them?
get rid of them is not a realistic expectation. Lake flies live in water. Their larvae are little red worms. In fact, they're sometimes referred to as blood worms, and they're kind of unique in the insect world because they do have hemoglobin associated with their body fluids for transporting oxygen, which is not common among insects. They live down in the lake muck and the like, and then the adults come out of lake flies, and they're really closely related to mosquitoes. They're just not a biting form of fly, and tremendous emergences, and then they tend to congregate. They are short-lived by nature, but if you get the right conditions, it's just billions of these come out. And if you're next to a lake, they often accumulate, especially if you've got security lighting, because many of these things are attracted to light, and that's what draws them on, and they rest during the day and do their thing at night. But their purpose is to find a mate very quickly and get on with things. So as I said, there really is not a realistic thing that makes any difference, other than if you'd poison the lake and kill everything that's in there, it wouldn't be. But, that's not a strategy that anybody would consider. So, unfortunately, you just have to kind of live with it, much like the people up at Lake Winnebago are well aware of when we get these mass emergences of lake flies. More typical in shallow, warm water lakes, it seems, rather than deeper lakes.
And we had another photo on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. My wife and sister, this is from Greg, found this while planting in my wife's garden box. I knew it was a larval stage of something, possibly a cicada. Could you settle our debate and tell us about its life cycle? I had thought that cicada larvae live off tree roots. This was a garden box.
Sure. It turns out it's a hornworm pupae. So this is going to turn into a sphinx or hawk moth, and it came from a hornworm caterpillar. I can't tell the species. We have almost almost two dozen different species you could expect to find. And What happens is the caterpillars, by nature, when they're done eating, burrow into the ground to make this dark chestnutty brown pupal case, and they're 3 to 4 inches long. And what was the giveaway? Because you will find smaller ones of these that are the caterpillars of cutworms and other moths, but it has a very long proboscis. It almost looks like a handle on a vase that's found there. Plus, the critter itself is about 3.5 inches long, and we don't have that many caterpillars that are that big in this state. So that's how they get through the winter. That's also how, in the summer, the ones that go through more than one generation get through, transform. The adult moth comes out at the appropriate time and then goes and flies off.
And John in Janesville has a question for you. Hi, John.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Wondering what the forecast is this year for Japanese beetles. I got hammered 2 years ago. Last year wasn't quite as bad, but I'm wondering if we're expecting to get more this year.
My take on this, and I'm not so sure my colleague Chris Williamson will totally agree with me, but what I find with Japanese beetles, I mean, they have been in my neighborhood for about 12 years now, and they were the most serious the first few years, and their populations have been under major decline. And I even have a colleague in soil science, Dr. Phil Barak, who keeps numbers of beetles. He catches them in his trap, he weighs his trap every night, and he can document a 50% decline each of the last 4 years. And I don't blame that on weather, because we've had various weather patterns. What seems to have happened, this is this invasive species population issue, that when they first get there and they're unchecked, they're the most serious. But then over time, things balance. Maybe not balance as well as we want, but things get better. So my question to you in Janesville, if the numbers were down last year, my gut feeling is they will be similar or down again this year. I wouldn't expect them to go the other way. For those communities where Japanese beetles have just started to show up in the last 3 or 4 years, I expect the exact opposite, because they're still on the population increase
upswing,
we see. And so that's my take on it. I've seen nothing to suggest otherwise in the areas where I've seen. And this cycle takes about 8 to 10 years to really start to kick in and get established. And as I said, Janesville has had a long history of Japanese beetles. So I would be encouraged by seeing the reduction last year that you're going to see similar reductions this year.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Joe in rural Dane County. Hi, Joe.
Hi, guys. Speaking of forecasts and things getting better, Phil, we haven't had any mosquito hatches yet to speak of, and this is pretty late in June for us. I live in eastern Dane County, not to have had a substantial hatch. I know you monitor traps. What's going on with the mosquito population? What's your theory? What's your forecast?
Well, part of it is, you know, compared to last year, which was, you know, what I consider normal bad, but it was very bad. The comment last year, Dr. Stan Temple, who is an emeritus professor in wildlife ecology, had shared with me that his mosquito traps, it was the worst he had seen in 30 years. Now, this is in one trap in Mazamani, but it was pretty nasty last year. But I would say I've seen the same thing that you have, is that things have been really pleasantly light. And in my backyard, I can go out and grill or play around in the flower bed even at dusk and really not have much of a problem. I'm a little surprised, only in that it seems it's been wet enough that we should have had a little bit more activity. But generally speaking, it has been quiet, and I anticipate it will stay quiet until we get a heavy rainfall pattern. Now, you know, we've got places north of Madison that got 2.5 inches of rain last night. You know, those areas you probably are getting enough flooding. The key is that you get water sitting for about 10 to 14 days, and that's enough to get the mosquito hatch off. And so far, as I said, the rainfall patterns have been such that the stuff has been soaking in the ground, and I don't see that changing unless we've had a significant change in rainfall in the next month or so.
There we go. It is strange how the rain, I mean, we had, I think, an inch and a half or inch and a quarter last night on our side of town, and Judith didn't notice much rain on her side of town.
Yeah, we're watching those thunderstorms, the way they popped up. In fact, because my wife and I were trying to figure out if we're going out for a walk or not, and, you know, you could see it on the east side, not the west. The one thing, though, I'll tell you from going from the walk last night, though, just at dusk, is, boy, the fireflies have come on big time here in the last 3 or 4 days, and I mean, I was seeing 30 or 40 in every lawn that I was looking at. So that was kind of fun.
Yeah, it was really a lot of fun. We sat on the porch after the rain last night and just watched hundreds of fireflies. It was really a lot of fun to watch. We have a photo on our Facebook page. This is from Carolyn in Reedsburg. She sent this picture in. Can you identify this bug? They were canoeing in Horicon Marsh.
Okay. I can tell it's a fly. It's only got one pair of wings. Because of the striping on it and whatnot, I'm inclined to call it a hoverfly, but I will tell you, flies are miserable to identify. We've got 113 families and almost 17,000 species, and I just can't see the detail. I mean, when we're identifying flies, we literally are looking at their wings. The lines are what we call veins in the wings. We're looking on the hairs of their face. You know, there's just a lot of detail I can't see. But said, other than telling you it's a fly, and because of the bee-like appearance, it could easily be a syrphid or what we call hoverfly. But I'm not 100% positive because, unfortunately, as they said, I can't see the detail that I would need to see.
It's still a pretty good picture.
Oh, yeah, very good picture.
Yeah. We have Sue in Phillips, Wisconsin, with a question or comment. Hi, Sue.
Hi. About people, now please don't get me wrong, I have two comments and one suggestion. People need to quit whining about nature and let it be. And I don't know how old you are, but in the 60s and 70s, they used what you call a patchouli oil. And water and oil don't mix. If these people that were complaining about swimming with his girlfriend or whatever, and the flies put patchouli oil on, you can get it at any, like, I don't know if you want to call it a hippie store or an herbal store. And this keeps mosquitoes away, ticks. You sweat, so the oil is stronger. And like I said, it won't come off in the water because it's oil-based. And that's my comment.
All right.
I'll take your comment off the air.
Thanks. All right, thanks.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of interest in natural oils. You know, there's a eucalyptus oil repellent that's out there now. I have never seen patchouli tested. It would be interesting to see how it does work. And, yes, I am of the era that I'm very familiar with patchouli oil. And so that, as I said, you know, there's a lot of these things, these natural plant compounds that have insecticidal activities of one sort or another. And so I appreciate your comment. In fact, I'll share it with my colleague, Susan Paskowitz, who has done some work with various repellents. You know, there's a soybean oil out there now called Bite Blocker that's a pretty effective repellent. Clove oil has got is being used as an insecticide now. And so a lot of these plant compounds do have very interesting biological activities.
And Emery sent us a picture of a, let's see, what is that? He calls
dragonfly.
It's a dragonfly?
Yeah. Now, the species I can't tell because I can't see enough of it. He did call it a clubtail, which is one of the families, and it very likely could be. As I said, I just would have to have a different perspective to be sure. But, you know, there are some, one of the neat things I've seen in my career is when I had first started, you know, it was very difficult to find field guides to identify things like dragonflies. But there's lots of books that have come out now that are really, you know, much like the bird field guides that are out there that give you enough detail that if you have an interest in dragonflies are, you know, not to put down the purple martins, but dragonflies are far more efficient at collecting mosquitoes and whatnot than any bird species I know. And so they deserve all the good press they can get.
There we go. Let's go to Mary Lois in Oshkosh now. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Hey, I have something of interest about the bees. I just read this last night in my new issue of Sierra magazine. If you can go online, probably pick it up on page 18 of the July-August issue 2010. And None of Your Beeswax is the title of it. And as it says in there, that talks about a pesticide that France has banned, and so has Germany, Italy, and Slovenia. And since they've done it, their bee population has rebirthed. And so get online. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but the pesticide is imidacloprid.
Imidacloprid, right.
Yeah, imidacloprid, and it says that it destroys the insect's nervous system, which causes them to get a disease.
Now, what do you think, Phil?
Well, you know, that one honestly is a little bit more controversial in the sense that imidacloprid was banned in France and elsewhere, and a lot of the early data that I had seen did not suggest it had an effect on the bee populations as far as allowing them to increase. Now, the other truth of the matter is that if bees are exposed to small amounts of this product, it does affect their behavior in a very similar manner to what colony collapse disorder is. And as I said, collapse disorder is a complex issue, but we know for a fact that diversities of pesticides and their potential effect on the immune system of the bee isn't helping the bee. But I guess I'll take my professional opinion is that's too simplified a story to blame it on this one particular compound. In particular, because the way this product is used, it's often used as a seed treatment, and I just don't see where the bees are getting a lot of exposure under that kind of treatment. Now, if it was used in a flowering crop system where it potentially could be showing up in the nectar and the bees are bringing it back, that would be of more concern. So I am aware of the discussion on that, and as I said, there are some parts of it that very much fit. But to me, just blaming all the bee problems we have on this particular product is far too oversimplifying the complexity of what's going on.
And just back to Michael for a minute. He has a tree doctor trying to sell both ash borer and Dutch elm disease treatments. The elm is large, shows it has no sign of any illness. I'm concerned about the ash borer, so he probably has some ash trees as well.
It's interesting. I speak first to the ash borer, emerald ash borer. Is my colleague Chris Williamson, who is our ornamental extension person and comes up with the recommendations. We were chatting yesterday. He had been back home in Ohio and was very disappointed to see how many ash trees are dying in northern Ohio. I mean, it's really taking off as wildfire. And Chris has typically suggested that we don't treat trees unless the problem is within 20 miles of where you're located. And he says he's considering rethinking that indeed if people have very valuable trees and they want to treat, but you still start to wonder, somebody in Bayfield that is, 150 miles away from any known infestations and whatnot, as long as you keep your ears open to the signs of activity, both on your own trees or what's going on in your area, I think you have time to react. It's not like this is going to happen overnight and all our ashes are going to die. So it just depends where you're located, what's going on in the general area for emerald ash borer. I'm not a plant pathologist, but from what I know of Dutch elm disease, typically we don't treat the trees until they have signs of the problem. Because it's an expensive treatment. It is an invasive treatment. And as I said, it's kind of like you don't take medicine until you get sick. Now, the other side of that, though, is you can't ignore the tree. You've got to be very observant for flagging and other signs of dieback so that the tree could be treated when it's needed. So it is a bit of a balancing act. If you're a type of person that, you feel more comfortable that the trees are treated, that you can sleep better, that's fine. But I think it's worth looking at it a little bit closer. And as I said, in evaluating it from that standpoint.
Mary in Richland Center was wondering about a bumblebee nest they have in their garden. How do we get rid of them?
Well, bumblebees, unfortunately, don't relocate very well. And what I find with bumblebees is they're really very passive. The only thing that gets bumblebees grumpy is if you go over their nest with a lawnmower or something similar. But you will find that normally, and it does depend on the species of bumblebee because different species have different temperaments. But normally you can work around them, and as long as the nest is not disturbed, they won't bother you. And what will happen is when we get in the fall of the year, the nest will die out naturally. So it's not something that's going to be there every year and get worse and worse over time. Now, if it's just outside the front door and you've got young kids and there's a chance that when they step off the stoop, they're going to step into it, then we've got an issue that we have to be concerned about. In particular, for those kind of nests, again, I'm a proponent of using a garden dust, and you dust the entrance, and when the bees come and go, they get the dust on their bodies, and that's what kills them. But as I said, it's only in specialized cases where there's a chance of pets or kids getting in the nest itself am I concerned. And in other cases, if it's out in the flower bed, I think you can let it be without any problem at all.
Phil, thanks so much. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Sounds good.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. He'll be back. We'll do this again with him. Tomorrow, we'll talk about colorectal cancer at 11. At 11:45, we'll talk about a consumer guide for farm-raised fish in Wisconsin. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.